welcome to New Zealand Vegan Podcast, episode 113. I'm here with a very, very special guest. This person, I've been wanting to interview them for a long, long time on my show for all the amazing things that they're doing. Please, everybody, welcome Sarah K. Woodcock. Welcome, Sarah.
Thank you so much, dear Elizabeth.
It's great to have you on. I just want to get straight into it and have you introduce yourself to everyone listening. And basically, I want you to talk about your amazing Abolitionist Vegan Society. You are the creator and founder of the Abolitionist Vegan Society, better known as TAVS. And I just want you to talk a little bit about how you actually managed to get that idea going and put it into practice. And but firstly, just sort of you can tell us a little bit about your abolitionist journey. I know you've written a beautiful story about it, which I'll post, but sort of how did you get started into veganism and abolition, you know?
Well, first of all, I just want to really thank you for having me on your show. It's kind of a momentous moment for me as well, because as I entered the abolitionist vegan movement, you were someone who stood out as like always being unequivocal, and I learned so much and continue to learn so much from your podcast that this is really special for me to be on your show as well, so thank you. So basically, my journey really started, like I think a lot of vegans, in that it started in the predominant welfarist owned movement. And I was fortunate, like I used to be Farm Sanctuary and Mercy for Animals' biggest fan. And I kind of shudder to think if they had, and PETA, like I used to support all of them. And I sort of shudder to think if I wanted to work for them. I just thought that was just, you know, what you do if you're really passionate about this. So anyhow, I was fortunate enough to come across someone on a blog. I don't remember what blog it was, but someone was actually criticizing Gary Francione for being divisive of the animal rights movement. And so that really kind of caught my attention. And I, at first, was really suspicious of Professor Francione. And I thought, why would someone want to do this? And you know, why would someone want to hinder, you know, in any way, this fantastic, you know, basically what I thought was the only hope that the animals had. And fortunately, I kind of am just so grateful looking back now that I really got to the bottom of that question, because I was either like, well, either he has an ulterior motive or he has a message that, you know, he really cares about and sincerely believes in. And I, you know, to make a long story short, I basically said, I don't understand why a man would basically disagree for over 30 years with the majority. And I don't understand, you know, what would be in it for him in doing that. And I saw them, you know, I came across him through being criticized. And I said, I don't understand why someone would subject themselves to this. So I said, just on a person-to-person level, I need to understand, you know, what this man's message is. And I need to understand if he's right. Because I thought, you know, and I hope the question everyone who comes across his work asks is, what if he's right? You know, if he's right, then we all have a tremendous responsibility. I think we all have a tremendous responsibility to get to the bottom of what if he's right, and if he's right, what does that mean for us on an advocacy level? So, you know, early in my journey, I was super excited about these orgs. I supported basically anything and everything that they did, and I also I wasn't really aware of the role of sexism in the movement. And so, you know, looking back, I can see myself saying things like, well, you know, I don't really like that women are, you know, taking off their clothes for the animals, and it kind of seems really silly, but I wouldn't have been quite as critical of that. And now that, you know, from Gary's work, I understand the, you know, the intersecting roles of oppression, I absolutely think that that's problematic, and I also think that it's actually counterproductive to, you know, trying to fight oppression with oppression, I now know it doesn't make sense. So basically, I was fortunate enough to come across his work, to get past my initial knee-jerk reactions of saying, you know, oh, just be quiet, you know, just we're all trying to help the animals, we all have the same goal. And I even remember having some of those thoughts, and I even remember having some of these thoughts of like, well, yes, vegetarianism isn't ideal, but, you know, that's how I went vegan. And so, you know, never really stopping to think like, but does that mean that we should promote that, you know? So I'm really grateful that, you know, that I came across that blog, and I hope more and more people now, especially with the presence of Tavs, will find his work and, you know, study it. And I think it's a really good investment of time and energy to study it, even if you think that you agree with some of the basic premises of the abolitionist approach, because you have heard about it, or maybe you follow him on Facebook. It's like, invest the time to read one of his books. Like, I recommend Animals as Persons, and I also recommend the Animal Rights Debate. And of course, his newest book, Eat Like You Care, is fabulous for becoming an effective advocate. But I think the investment of actually learning his work and figuring out the historical context of where we are today is so critically important. So what I came across was finding, you know, in this movement is that, okay, I eventually found, like, okay, this guy's right. This is like, and I knew the journey that I went to in but just by happenstance coming across him, I thought, this guy's right, and it's wrong that so few advocates know about him. And so I thought, you know, if it's true what he's saying, that like the predominant movement's going backwards and so few animal advocates know about him, you know, that's really problematic. And I said, well, you know, first of all, my background is in technology, but also in marketing. And so I have some of a sense, you know, somewhat of a sense of the importance of, like, you know, he had the foundation for the abolitionist approach. He had it all worked out through decades of research and decades of, you know, academic writing and, you know, defending this, his work, and, you know, everything it took to develop it.
Not to mention hands-on sort of doing it right back in the beginning, being part of it. I mean, doing it, you know, and then saying, this isn't working. Hey, everyone, this isn't working.
Exactly. And like, I can't remember if I heard it in an audio interview or if I read this, but he, you know, he was talking about how he would be working on these, to paraphrase, working on these laws, and how he would be so ecstatic that, you know, this is a victory, we're getting this law in place, it's going to help animals. And then seeing that by the time it made its way through, it was so watered down that it was almost useless. So it's like, you know, he's been there firsthand. It's not just academic, it's not just ivory tower. It's like he's like the best of both worlds. He's got the theory, and he also has the personal experience. And obviously the personal experience nowadays with the vegan advocacy as well. So what I started to do is, you know, help with his Facebook page and make posters and really try to grow his page and get his work known by more people, because it is so common sense and it makes sense. But there are so, I mean, as many knee-jerk reactions as there are against veganism, there are against abolitionist veganism.
Absolutely.
And so it's, you know, it's like we have like this double, people think when they get to vegan that they've made it and that they're there and that all they have to do is turn around now and start advocating. But there's a whole, it's like, sorry to break it to you, but there's a whole other layer of learning that you've got to invest in, and that, you know, if you want to be an active advocate, you know, it pays to do that extra level of learning. So I started to make posters and, you know, really try and get his work out there as much as possible. And what I started to realize was that, you know, even though I agree and I completely accept that, like, the standard organizations are not going to be able to do it for us and that we cannot donate our way out of this problem, I realized that there is value in having a comprehensive set of resources and a comprehensive structure, that people do. There's something in human nature, and I don't exactly know how to describe it, but I think there's something in human nature that we do like to associate ourselves with an organization of some sort. And so I thought, how can I take, you know, the good of that people want the organizational aspect, but leave out the bad of how, you know, these organizations get corrupted and how the money, so little of a donation goes to quote unquote help. And then we know that if the message is compromised, that like none of the money goes to actually help, and that you're at, you know, it's a whole big mess. And, you know, there's just this watering down that happens where, you know, the organizations don't ask people to go vegan, and it's a self-perpetuating just disaster, because then they hire employees and then they have to water down the message even more. And the very organization that set out perhaps to help animals, you know, ends up doing the opposite. So what I basically wanted to do was figure out how to bring the abolitionist approach to life. And I thought, how can we do this? So I started putting together ideas of like what we would want. We'd want a really good, unequivocal abolitionist vegan leaflet that can be used by people in their advocacy. We'd want comprehensive website articles that people can send people to educate them about veganism. And, you know, it's all the Abolitionist Vegan Society. I founded it based on the abolitionist approach, but it's different. You know, Gary is not involved. He has no official role whatsoever with the Abolitionist Vegan Society. So it's like my interpretation and my take on the abolitionist approach, you know, brought to life. And I thought the abolitionist approach is fantastic, and we need to educate vegans about it. But the key is really that it needs to get to non-vegans. And so really the Abolitionist Vegan Society is meant to reach non-vegans and to be that organization that they first encounter veganism through, so that their loyalty, instead of being to like a farm sanctuary, Mercy for Animals, PETA, HSUS, is instead to an abolitionist vegan organization, so that I hope that it can be self-perpetuating. So basically now we've got this website. We've been up since, I think we announced in June. So we've been up now about 6 months, and
Oh my God, that's so fantastic. I mean, as you know, I absolutely love it. And I think first thing I want to say is that it's actually really makes me feel good. And you're not the first person that's had it, but it kind of comforts me to know that, you know, because there's so many people out there who criticize Gary Francione, but it's actually bringing people to his work, and good is coming out of it. So that's really good. It's not the first time I've heard that, where people have seen seen something denigrating his ideas, but then the person reading it said, "Oh, let me go and investigate this," and then they're like, "Oh my God, he's right." And the person who was criticizing him, I don't agree with them. So that was really, really cool. Obviously he is right, as we know. So I'm glad that you figured that out as well. I also had the same. I mean, I was pointed to him by people who supported him, but that. The bottom line is contrary to popular belief, we actually do think for ourselves, and we go there and read his stuff, and we make that decision in the moment, like, does this make sense or does this not make sense? And to me, it made sense. To you, it made sense. And to more and more other people, it's making sense. And I also want to say thank you, because, you know, when you were talking about how when you first got involved and actually started making the posters and wanting to get people to his work, I mean, wow, his Facebook page now has 33,000 likes, which is pretty significant considering it had a lot less than that before you came along with your posters. So you really do seem to understand how to get this out to a lot of people, and I'm so, so grateful to you for doing that, for this work. And it was kind of sad to me, like, because this is in the last, what would you say that this activity since you've been begun, I mean, it's been what, a year and a half? Is that, would that be fair? A year and a half that you've been doing the...
It's been a year. It's been just over a year that I've really gotten into doing the posters.
Wow.
I've been following his work for about a year and a half, and you know, I just watched his page. Like, you know, some people come onto his page and I think that they see one thing they disagree with and they argue, and, you know, on day one. And I just really, first of all, when I found out that he had a Facebook page and that he would interact with the public, I was thrilled. You know, to be able to learn directly from him is just such a gift. And so I just, you know, liked his Facebook page and just sat back and watched the other people kind of you know, chime in with the knee-jerk reactions and then watched his response and then watched other people's response that were both, you know, not in support of his views and in support of his views. And that's really how I learned. And then, you know, he would then sometimes link to his essays and then I'd go read the specific essays. And one thing I really love about his Facebook page and his Twitter are that, is that you can get his take on current events. You know, because when you're first learning, it's like you see something, and when if you're coming from the welfarist movement mindset, you know, you might see something that at first you would think is a victory. For example, the India granting personhood to dolphins. You know, most people would intuitively think that that's a great thing. They wouldn't necessarily think that that reinforces the idea that personhood is only really you know, due to people or to animals that are human-like. Yeah. So, you know, it makes you, I just liked, you know, getting his take on current events. It's really helpful.
Oh, that's interesting. That's, I never thought about it that way. I've just taken it for granted, actually, haven't I? Yes, I have. So that'll give me some pause to sort of appreciate it. You know, the fact that you're right that he is out there interacting with the public. Peter Singer doesn't have a Facebook page where he interacts with the public, I don't think. For example,
No, I don't think he does.
Yeah,
and I don't.
Yeah. So that is pretty amazing. But I also wanted to comment on the TAVS. I know that it's your organization and you've done it. Gary doesn't have an official role. But you say it's your interpretation of I mean the articles and everything are, and but at least you know the thing I like about it is you're unequivocal about pointing people towards Gary Francione and his work. You're not hiding the fact. You know what I mean. I appreciate that.
Absolutely.
Because I try to do that as well. I mean I've tried various little minor projects that have been totally unsuccessful, but the intention was there in New Zealand to try to have an abolitionist Auckland abolitionist movement and things like that. And but I always my whole point of my website and everything was really I really wanted as a even my podcast. I remember my episode 4. I'll never forget it because I started doing the podcast and I realized I really wanted people because he hadn't told me I hadn't had any kind of contact with Gary directly, and I never thought I would because nobody else who's like has quote celebrity unquote status in anything, you know, interacts, you know what I mean, gives you their time.
Absolutely.
And stuff.
And so I just
remember clearly saying that if all this podcast does is make people go to his website, I'm happy. Like that's really what I wanted people to do is what you said, go and read the stuff for themselves and figure out, you know, make up their own minds about it. And people are, and that's why we've got a growing movement because the theory is infallible and people love it. And one of the beautiful things about it, about the abolitionist approach is it's all inclusive. Another thing you mentioned to the sexism in the movement, and as a female, you had not actually had that sexism in the movement, Peter, and all that challenged until you read Gary's challenges of it, and also the xenophobic and racist campaigning.
Absolutely.
As well. And I know that you've been victim directly of xenophobia and racism as an animal rights activist. It's a horrible thing for you to have to go through, but I'm glad it happened after. I don't know if it happened before, but I'm glad it happened after you had exposure to Gary's work and you could see what was going on and have something, a response to them other than just genuine hurt and total despair. And, you know, I mean, it must be just,
totally.
It must be, I can't imagine what it's like because I haven't been subjected to that, but Gary's work is all inclusive. So that's why we have an abolitionist vegan society chapter in Africa now, in Kenya. There's people out there advocating it, I should say, and hopefully there'll be a chapter one day. So, you know, it's all inclusive. And in New Zealand, TAVS chapter, partner, the one we were doing it together is Tuanekore Peters, Bubs Peters, and he's Cook Island Maori, and he's from Rarotonga, and we're going to go to South Auckland, which is the Pacific Island community here. And if it weren't for him getting involved, I've said that before in my podcast. I know that the abolitionist approach appeals to everybody, no matter your race, no matter your sex, no matter your demographic, no matter what, no matter your religion. That's the beauty of it. It's just beautiful. And we're seeing that happening, and we're seeing people who can bring it to their communities. And that's such a beautiful thing. It's definitely a growing movement. So, and it's thanks to you for getting it going. I think you're right about organization. I just pushed ahead and just did my thing anyway. But there were a lot of people who wanted an organization, and they'd come up to my street stall and they'd say, "Well, who are you affiliated with? Where did you get all this stuff? What's the organization?" And I'd be like, "Oh no, it's just me. You know, you can do it too." But now I feel like for people who, and most people do seem to sort of want that and need that, and I can understand why, I can say, join this movement. The beautiful thing about TABS is it's a movement. It's not just an organization that they can join.
Absolutely.
Or that they can take advantage of the resources, or that they can market or whatever. It's a movement, and that's one of the things I loved about it. Do you want to talk a little about the TABS chapters for people?
Sure, yeah, and I wanted to go back to one point that you made about, the Abolitionist Vegan Society being based on the abolitionist approach, and I am so proud that it is based on the abolitionist approach. I mean, as you and I have discussed in separate conversations, it's like every single one of those principles is so critical. Every single one of the six principles matters to the success of a real animal rights movement. And I think that, you know, just drop one off and it's like, you know, you have a pitfall, and you have something that would necessarily cause that movement not to be able to be successful. I really want people to learn his work. The more they learn his work, the more they can be even more educated, even more effective in their own communities. And then by all means, if they want unequivocal resources that they can use in their advocacy and know that, you know, the non-vegan that they send back to TABS is not going to be, bombarded with graphic imagery, asking women to do sexist campaigning, participating in any racist campaigning itself, anything like that, then absolutely TABS is like, you know, a great option for them. But yeah, I'm really proud that the Abolitionist Vegan Society is based on the abolitionist approach. And I think that, and I'm eternally grateful to Gary for, you know, not only creating and, you know, using all of his talents and all of his skills and all of his intelligence and everything to make it, but just to have the perseverance to defend it over all these years with so much criticism. So I'm very grateful. But yeah, so basically we have what's called TABS chapters. And TABS chapters are the local representation of TABS, because we are a grassroots movement. We believe in the individual vegans and their communities to go out into their communities and talk with non-vegans. It's all about these conversations that are going to really shift, as Gary says, you know, the conversation from the uninteresting idea of how we use animals to a much more interesting idea of are we morally justified in using them at all. And, you know, based on his work, we know that most people already agree with veganism. And so it, you know, learning his work, it just makes advocacy so much easier. And so, you know, part of kind of maintaining the giving some structure, so to speak, to our movement was coming up with just what I'm calling TABS chapters. And what they are is people who see the abolitionist approach and, you know, gain a more advanced understanding of what it's about and why the six principles are so important. And they agree with, you know, the fundamental tenets of it, and they really want to be part of the growing movement in their own community, which is so important. As you mentioned, we do have some TABS advocates in Kenya who are doing advocacy, and that's just like, it brings so much hope. What they can do is they can actually apply to lead a TABS chapter. So, you know, people to do abolitionist vegan advocacy, someone does not have to run a TABS chapter, but if they really want to, you know, be a very active part of this abolitionist vegan movement. They can apply to run one. So what you do is you can go to abolitionistvegansociety.org/TAVS-chapters. So it's TAVS-chapters. And what that is we basically, we want to make sure that the individual is unequivocally understanding and dedicated to all the six principles. In other words, we don't want someone who represents TAVS to be, you know, doing single issue campaigns. We want them to be doing unequivocal abolitionist vegan education in their communities. And so we basically require, you know, that they read three of Gary's books, and then Eat Like You Care is one of them. That was co-written by Gary Francione and Anna Charlton. And basically, we have them write an essay and then go through kind of a questionnaire. And we basically, we just really want to make sure that, you know, the dedication is there and that they're willing to do the requirements, which are just that they do, you know, an advocacy outreach, creative nonviolent vegan education in their community at least once per month. And, you know, that they provide feedback to TAVS on how that went. We really want to, you know, in my role, I want to facilitate and support the movement in all of these different communities around the world as well as I can. I run TAVS as a volunteer, so I am somewhat limited in that, you know, I don't do this full time and I don't do this for money. I just do it for volunteering. So, but I do my best to really support this movement because I think that, you know, gaining a presence in all of these different places around the world is what's going to increase the chances of someone being exposed to the vegan argument instead of, you know, the cage-free or happy exploitation argument.
Absolutely. So, absolutely. And mm-hmm. You're doing an amazing job with the resources that you're providing as one person. It's truly astonishing. Sorry, I didn't want to interrupt.
No worries. So I've been really excited that, like, we've got, of course, TAVS New Zealand, run yes. by you and Bob.
Yeah.
and you two are just so inspiring and so fantastic. Like, I'm trying to track advocacy as much as possible because I think the more we can find out how effective our advocacy is and, you know, getting feedback from our chapters on what works, what doesn't work, what works better than other things, you know, the more we can refine and enhance our techniques, the better. And with that said, like, I get so much feedback and registrations that say that they've heard of the Abolitionist Vegan Society from NZ Vegan and from TAVS New Zealand. And so, you know, you two are two people and you're making such an impact, not only in, you know, I think reaching the non-vegans in your community, but also in showing up and doing your stall and, you know, posting those pictures. I mean, those pictures may just seem, you know, really simple to you and that you're just out, you know, doing what you do, talking about veganism with people. And yet they're so inspiring. And I know that firsthand because when I first did in-person advocacy, it was inspired by you. So I know that, you know, you've been so influential in that regard. And then we also have a TAVS chapter, one of the first in the world. So we have New Zealand. We also have Sweden, which is run by Andreas Manson. I think that's how I pronounce his name. And then we also have TAVS Norway, which is run by Anders Branderud. And again, I hope I'm pronouncing his name correctly. And then I run TAVS Minnesota, which is in the state of Minnesota in the United States. And so right now we have four chapters, and that's in only 6 months. And, you know, we vet our TAVS chapter leads pretty carefully. So this is really exciting because this means that these are people who are unequivocally dedicated to the abolitionist approach and the abolitionist vegan movement and growing, you know, growing the right way and based on really solid theory. So I think it's really exciting.
It is really exciting, and it's an honor to be, absolutely an honor to be part of it. And it's, for me, it's providing much needed how can I say it? It's just the beauty of a movement and the beauty of having a variety of talents and different advantages. As like, for example, very important things like a website and solid resources that are well formulated, and those are things. I mean, I just don't have that as well. So as well as all the other things that you've contributed, just having this solid foundation that is reliable and is so well professionally done. It's beautifully done. I mean, your posters alone are unbelievable. I just want to post a link to actually, honestly, because we're going to be using them. We've got so many ideas, and Bubs has been incredible. I mean, I'm going to get him back on the show, but because he's got he this is the beauty of having so many different people. There's so many, you need more than one person. Can't do it alone, and that's the whole point of a movement. And so we've got all the beautiful resources and the talents that you bring as well. And but like the most important thing that we all bring is, like you say, a solid knowledge of the work. I've been reading and studying the work, and I'm not gonna never gonna stop, because I learn something new every day. And it
Absolutely.
was so true what you said. It's so true what you said, that we need informed advocates out there. It's so important. People don't understand how important that is. And I've always told people, like, who've 'cause I mean, I didn't invent the whole idea of going out and doing, stalls. The first people that I saw doing it was the Boston Vegan Association, actually, doing unequivocal vegan stalls, or tabling or whatever like that. Before that, the only thing I'd ever seen to do in relation to supposed veganism was PETA screaming through bullhorns and things like that. So for me, it was a revelation that these people were getting out in the community, and so that's what inspired me to do it in New Zealand. But the difference is they had this big fancy setup, and they had this gorgeous professional looking pamphlet, right? And they had a group. I didn't have any of that. They did provide me with their pamphlet, which was very nice. Back in the beginning, but even before I got that pamphlet, I was just me and this rickety little table. And I think that that's what people, when I started doing that and posting the pictures, other people would have been too embarrassed to post those pictures. Well, not me, because I'm like, I don't care if it's this little secondhand card table from my dad, that he gave me his, that he used to, sit in front of the TV with. I was like, you, one person, as much as I, because I didn't have tabs then. I did not have tabs then, but I just had my voice, and that's what I think is so and so important. So now we have our voices, which I've always said is the most important, but now we have this solid, consistent, sort of global resources which are pr
Absolutely.
provided by tabs. So that to me is making all the difference. When you look at when I look at when I post a photo of the street stall and try to inspire other people, though I am going to totally clean up the street stall now. I feel like it's always been really raggedy, but that to me was I think that that I think I hope that that showed people, because I remember people writing to me back in the day and saying, "Oh my gosh, your table's so small and you're all by yourself," and they were like, "But hey, it's great." And I was like, "Well, you can do it too. If I can drag this on the bus and go and sit with a little stall, on a corner." Sometimes people wouldn't even notice me, but the people who did notice me, and we would talk, and I'm like, "That person got a conversation today that they would never have gotten if I wasn't here."
Absolutely.
So I think that's what the beauty of that. And now we've got the beautiful Tavs resources with this recognizable logo, for example, that I keep telling people when I meet people from Italy, when I meet people from Spain, I'm like, keep an eye out in your country, because there's going to be a Tavs movement there. There's going to be a chapter there, and you need to, if you're interested in this, then you could go be part of it. So I'm like, keep an eye out. Next time when you're walking around, if you see this logo, it does it, because right now with the translations, that's a huge body of work. I know that everything's going to be translated, but right now it's in English. Majority of it's in English, but I'm like, next time you go back to Italy, eventually, it doesn't know where, I don't know how long it's going to take, but I believe it's going to get there. And I'm like, and then now you can go and help them, because they're like, I love what you're doing, I want to do it too. And I'm like, well, you either need to just do it and stop talking about it, or keep an eye out because there are going to be people doing it, and they're the people you want to join, not the ones screaming through bullhorns, waving shark finning posters, or anti, vivisection, or dressed up in bikinis made out of lettuce. Those are not the people you want to go to. Go to the where the Tavs logo is, because guaranteed there's this foundation of consistency and like you say, the principles and every one of them important. So, yeah,
Exactly.
it is.
And
It's simple.
I love the humble stalls. Like I love we have to always keep those photos of you in your original stalls because that is the reality of the movement and how it started. And now of course we all have days where like we feel hopeful and we feel not hopeful and it's like we can always look back to those stall pictures and I think they're beautiful. I think that it's not about how they physically look. I think it's about what they stand for. And I actually love the fact that they're like, pre-Tavs logo. I just think they're beautiful in that way and what they stood for, and that someone believed in an idea that was just so beautiful and so actually freeing for the animals. It's like, you can't put a price on that, so.
It is so inspiring, and I'm very, very grateful to Gary Francione. And if he hadn't come along, oh my gosh, I would be in a chicken suit. I would be in a chicken suit collecting money for a safe. I know I would. I just,
I would absolutely be in one as well.
collecting money for Mercy for Animals. Isn't it amazing? And you know
Oh,
what's
absolutely.
and you know one of the things I do when I'm at the stall is I try to quickly remind people, because like you say, when you it does make advocacy so much easier when you've read the books. And I really want to recommend Animals, the Introduction to Animal Rights as well is just priceless. I mean, all of the books, but definitely Animals as Persons, as you said, and the Animal Rights Debate. But I mean, and Eat Like You Care, obviously, especially for advocacy, especially for advocacy now. I mean, we can talk a little bit more about that actually, because I know that you actually were a part of the process of that book. And I heard a rumor, a little bird told me, that you designed the cover, which just shows more of your wonderful talent. Did you really design the cover? Because I love it.
I actually use like stock imagery for it, but I did the layout of it, so to speak.
But I mean, you picked that imagery. You know what I mean? I'm not saying you sat there and drew the knife and fork as food, but I'm saying, you
Okay,
designed it.
yes, I did that.
And it's eye-catching. It really, really is. It's that's just this is the beautiful thing. And I know that sometime in New Zealand there's going to be someone who's going to come along, because I want to have a better sort of like for a better place for me to put up the photos locally, like on some kind of page, a Tavs chapter page link to my NZ Vegan blog or whatever. And I just don't have the skill to do it. And I know that there's going to be some little computer guy's going to come along one day, I don't know when, and he's going to be like, I want to help you out. I'm an abolitionist. I've read the books. I'm in. And I'm like, and he's like, and I can do this. And I'll be like, oh, thank God you came along. Now you can please do that for me, because I can't do it. These are the kind, so we all contribute, we all contribute something valuable. But the most important thing that people need to contribute is the self-education. They have an obligation to educate themselves, and that's why I love how there's required reading before you can be a Tavs chapter. And also because the word and the whole concept of abolition is becoming sort of almost trendy in a way now, it is getting, there are people who think they are abolitionists, but they actually, upon further questioning or self-examination, they realize they're not actually abolitionist. I have people saying, I really support, I totally believe it, I really agree. And then I'll go on their page and it's like single issue after single issue after single issue. And I'm like, you actually don't agree then. You
I think
say you
people
agree.
like unfortunately equate the terminology of abolition with like that you support it could be, well, Gary has written about this, how it can mean many different things. And some people think that if they are okay with abolishing one type of animal use, like, let's say no kill, the no kill movement, someone there might say, I want to abolish killing in shelters. And then some people may, on the other extreme, may even be supportive in theory of abolishing all animal use for food. Or maybe even all animal use. But as you and I know, we wouldn't necessarily assume that that person is an abolitionist according to the abolitionist approach. So it is so critically important that people learn the theory, and it is not time wasted. It is one of the best investments that you can make, is to just get these books and take your advocacy to the next level by learning. And it's like, I don't think one could regret, learning this theory. It's so helpful. And, even in the confidence level in your advocacy, it's so helpful.
Exactly. And that's one of the things about Eat Like You Care as well, is it's really helping. It's really helping people get out there. And the reviews alone say it. Just this has really put it, in a way that I feel more confident talking to people. And definitely not time wasted. So glad you said that. Take time out from wearing your chicken suit and raising money for, SAFE or whatever, and which I believe is time wasted, personally. And, read the books. And at the very least, you're going to know where you stand then, and you're going to be clear. Now, I personally can't understand anyone reading, for example, Animals as Persons or Animals, Property and the Law or the Animal Rights Debate and continuing to support welfare. I can't understand that, but I can't understand everything under the sun. I'm not saying that it's just unfathomable to me, but apparently there
are
people.
I think if someone reads one of those, and this is sort of like when I was not familiar with the abolitionist approach, and I wanted to understand why Gary was, promoting the ideas for so long and defending them. It's like I needed to understand in my own thinking. I needed to understand and be able to articulate why. So I envisioned myself, if someone came up to me and said, oh, have you heard about that Gary Francione guy? What do you think of his work? Why don't you support him? Like, let's say I had researched it and decided I didn't agree. Well, I just, on an integrity level, I thought, I need to be able to have a well-thought-out answer. The animals are worth a well-thought-out answer as to, like, why do you not agree? And I realized, if I can't articulate why I don't agree, then that's problematic. If I can only resort to an ad hominem as far as like why I don't agree, then that is not good enough for the animals. So it's like we need to, I think, research and understand why we agree or why we disagree, and we need to be able to articulate why. And I think that most everyone who will actually take the time to understand, they will understand and, be enriched by what they learn.
That's right. And I've noticed a difference, I have to tell you. I don't know about you, because I know you were actually very active in the animal community in your community. I wasn't. I came to New Zealand as a new vegan, a very new vegan, and as a very new abolitionist, still learning, but pretty much had figured out that, oh, no. And I can hear the dogs in the background. It's so adorable.
I love it.
No, I could
grab your toy.
And I could hear the little growl before, and then I could hear the little...
Oh, goodness.
It's so cute. But, sorry. But yeah, so I just was wondering if you've noticed a difference, because I have to tell you, don't necessarily have my finger on the pulse of what the mainstream animal movement is doing here, because I got very disillusioned very, very fast with it and just sort of struck out on my own. But I have noticed a difference, because there are these new pages coming up. There are these new people coming up, some of whom I have talked to in the past who were completely shut down to the idea, whose rhetoric alone is changing. I've happened to come across articles where people are writing stuff, and they're still welfareists, they're still single issue, but their language has changed immeasurably, and they're putting in this, they have changed. So even though they're still not what I would consider abolitionists or whatever, just they are already changing. I mean, even the welfare movement is being influenced, because they're volunteers who are probably still, maybe still loyal, maybe haven't actually read the books and maybe haven't actually educated themselves. The rhetoric is out there, and they're saying things like, we need more vegan advocacy. I mean, we definitely need to focus on vegan advocacy. I saw somebody say that. And I was like, thank you. Thank you very much. I mean, that about, yes, and hurry up with it. And it is changing. And so even people who are, the influence is growing. So even people who are resistant, or who were formerly resistant, or who don't understand it, or who've never really read anything, they unconsciously or consciously are being influenced by it, because it is it is the way to go. It just is the way to go.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, as you've participated in one of the reasons, we have these what's called the TAVS Weekend Challenges. And if you go to our Facebook page, which is just facebook.com/abolitionistvegansociety, you'll find our Facebook page and pinned, we have a post that we pin to the top of our Facebook page every single week. And what it is it's called the TAVS Weekend Challenge, but really it goes, you know, every single day is a TAVS challenge. And what it is to go into your community and engage in creative, nonviolent vegan education. And, I think that this is absolutely necessary, and it's also going to help, as you said, you know, get this into the conversation, because I think that when someone goes out into their community and does creative nonviolent vegan education, and it's effective, and it makes vegans, like we have people registering with TAVS constantly who say that they came across a TAVS advocate, they got the right literature, and guess what? They're going vegan. They're not going vegetarian. They're not going meatless Monday. They're going vegan because we're planting the appropriate seeds and we're, you know, conveying a message that actually makes sense, that if animals matter, you don't participate in exploiting them. It just makes sense. It doesn't make sense to say if animals matter, you do Meatless Monday. That just literally doesn't make sense to a non-vegan or to a vegan. It shouldn't make sense, you know? And I think that I think we're going to see more and more of what you're saying of, you know, this, the abolitionist rhetoric, you know, infiltrating, I hope, the welfarist movement, because success will breed success. And the more that we can get people to take these TAVS weekend challenges and to report back and say, hey, guess what? I went into my community and I promoted veganism and, you know, I got people thinking. Doesn't necessarily mean that every single person on the spot is going to commit to going vegan. But, you know, I've had many experiences where I'll talk to people and you can tell by the things that they're saying and by the look on their face that they are sincerely and genuinely thinking about what you've said. And finally, you know, they've had an unequivocal message, you know, in their lives. So I think we're going to see more and more of that as people get more and more involved with abolitionist vegan advocacy and more involved in TAVS advocacy. We're only going to see more and more of that. And I hope that it continues to influence, you know, other advocates and other organizations even, you know, that would be great if we can get more, you know, the word vegan appropriately used. You know, the more we can get that, the better.
I agree fully. And this is so exciting because I love talking to you about this because, you know, I just, you're right there with me and it's so nice. So can we just briefly talk, if you will, about the TAVS PIN campaign?
Mm-hmm. TAVS PIN campaign, it's our only campaign. The TAVS PIN campaign, I thought, you know, in the welfarist movement, there's like, what, 1,000,004 campaigns?
Yeah.
And it's like, even if you wanted to support them all, I mean, how could you? But then you can through a vegan campaign. That's how you support campaigns to, you know, end suffering. That's veganism. Basically, the TAVS PIN campaign is, it's basically a campaign that I thought of because I wanted to encapsulate everything that, you know, if we were to make a campaign, what would it be? And it would basically be to end all animal use. I'm not going to, you know, dance around what our mission is or what our goal is. Our goal is to end animal use. We as humans have absolutely no justification in using other sentient beings for our gain or for our enjoyment or whatever we, you know, try to justify. It's not just. It's not right. And so earlier this year, we launched the TAVS PIN campaign, the worldwide campaign to end all animal use. Basically, what it is it's a campaign with an actual pin. It's a pin, and we're actually kind of, we started with an actual pin that was made out of metal, and we're now moving to this button that gets fulfilled through, if you go to TAVSPIN.com, you'll get the link to the button. And what we do is we encourage vegans, they have to be vegan to wear the pin. We encourage them to wear their pin every day to protest the grave injustice of all animal use, because it's a justice issue. And we'll talk about this in a little bit, but it's not about having compassion as people. It's about an ethic of justice that we owe directly to animals. So we encourage vegans to wear their pin every day to state their protest to the injustice of animal use and to initiate powerful conversations about veganism. So just today I was wearing my Tavs pin, and we went to a family event, and one of my family members said, you know, now what's that? And I explained what it is, and we immediately got into a conversation about veganism. And that's exactly what it's meant to do. It's meant to have people say, now what's that? And similar to what you were talking about earlier about, you know, recognition of this logo, it's like, it's a way to wear the Tavs logo and to have this united symbol that vegans can stand behind and can wear, but can also use as an advocacy conversation starter. So basically what you want to do is you want to go to tavspin.com, order your pin/button. You can also order pins and buttons for your vegan friends and family. And then you want to wear your pin every day and spread the word. It's basically a way that we raise a little money from the Tavs Pin campaign. And what we do with that is, as I mentioned before, I don't make any money from the Abolitionist Vegan Society. It all goes back to abolitionist veganism. And so the majority of our funds go to providing leaflets to people who can't afford them. Because we want, if an abolitionist vegan, if a vegan wants to do advocacy, we want them to be able to have access to leaflets, because it's critically important that everyone who wants to promote veganism unequivocally has access to these. So, you know, the funds from the Tavs Pin campaign and all donations to Tavs really go directly to the root, you know, getting to the root of the problem. We're not dancing around with any sort of other silly campaigns to end this or reform this or modify this. We believe in veganism.
Absolutely. That's so cool. And I wear my pin every day. I really, really, I really do. I just want to also say that I'm going to put up, I've got a lot of posters. I've decided to do a whole new wallpapering of my cubicle at work with all of your posters that you've made, for some for Gary and some for the Abolitionist Vegan Society, because they are the voice that I can't sit there and say over and over, because I'm working, and also because you know, I'm a very passionate person, and people say that to me. They say it as a compliment, but they also say it as a little kind of, not negative, but they, it doesn't always work in my favor, to be quote passionate, because I get very passionate, and I get you could say strident and all these kinds of things. So, you know, I've had little run-ins, not run-ins at my job, but there are times where I cannot stand it and somebody will say something to me and my passion will come out. And so I can't sit there all day and say what I want to say. Like, it's going through my head constantly. Anybody who's vegan, I'm sure, and I know they do, we all feel it. I'm at work and I can smell, because I'm really close to the kitchen, you see, and I'm sitting at my desk doing my job, and I can smell the injustice. I can actually smell the corpse, you know, the corpse is cooking. I have people right next to me pouring the milk of stolen babies into their cereal. You know, I'm having people put their leather bag, you know, on the desk next to me. I mean, this is just part of life. And my voice wants to cry out basically every second of every day. And one of the ways for me to comfort myself is to have the vegan posters on my cubicle, and they comfort me, and they are saying what I want to say to everybody every second of every day. They're saying it silently, not to disturb the workplace. And also, you can't force people to talk to you. You can't force people to listen to you. So I don't get the opportunity to talk to people at my job as much as I'd like, just like I don't get the opportunity to talk to my family. Other people have luck with their family. I don't. They don't want to talk about it with me. That's one of the reasons why I started doing this podcast, firstly, and that's the other reason why I started doing street advocacy, because I had to get it out. And I was like, if my family's not going to talk to me, I know complete strangers will. I know they will, because they won't be able to resist the argument. Whereas my family are just like, not interested, stop, you know. So one of the things I like to do is, like you say, wear the pin and wear the word vegan. Definitely. I wear my vegan jacket to work every day in the summer. And I want to put your posters up, because your posters say things that I really, really want to say. Well, they're quotes from Gary Francione, basically. So every time you drink a glass of milk or have a piece of cheese, you harm a mother. That's going on my wall. The idea that palate pleasure or fashion can justify inflicting da da da, I can't remember the exact quote, is like one of the most morally repugnant ideas in the whole. That is going on my cubicle. And I want people to stop by and read them. And I work with people who dedicate their lives to combating child abuse and domestic violence, and so the disconnect is huge, but they're very clear as to where I stand. Don't worry, everybody, they know. But I do comfort myself with them. So I recommend, if you have a cubicle, go to Gary's Francione's Facebook page and click on photos and just pick a few. And there's some with the most, because like Sarah, you're really talented. I don't know what it's called. I don't know the lingo. Is it graphic design or whatever you call it? But it's the most beautiful photos of flowers. And then, and then you have the quote, the applicable quote. My computer wallpaper right now is the beautiful, I don't know if that's a lotus or a lily, a pink lily, and it says veganism is not a limitation in any way. It's an expansion of your love, your commitment to nonviolence, and your belief in justice for all. And it's a beautiful image. And that's actually on my Tavs banner. I love that quote. And people stop and read that. And that's what I want people to hear. I think people respond to that. So I'm just excited about all these beautiful posters you've made, because they're going to be helping me cope at my job. So thank you, personally,
Oh, it's wonderful.
for helping me cope in this non-vegan, world that we live in.
Yeah, it's amazing sometimes, like when you've gone through the transformation of going vegan, and then the even bigger transformation of going abolitionist vegan. It's like, and when you really recognize that it's a justice, it's a really, really, deep justice issue, and the pervasiveness and the mass acceptance of such a horrible, horrible injustice. It's like, it's mind-blowing at times. So I'm glad that the posters have brought you comfort, and I hope that they also, give vegans the strength to realize that, they're not alone.
Exactly. And they say the things that need to be said. The animal that we can talk a little bit. I think you wanted to bring up the compassionate thing and stuff. The wishy-washiness is the way it's, for me, it's so wishy-washy. The mainstream movement. I could not believe it. I occasionally go on Safe's Facebook page, but generally I don't, because it's too sad and depressing, actually, to be quite honest. I could probably, if I wanted to, and I've debated it, and I'm just, I just don't know if I want to do it. Probably I should. I could, my entire NZ Vegan page could just be excerpt after excerpt, or example after example after example of the speciesism, the ineffectiveness, the backwardness of Safe's entire, what they do, like on their Facebook page, on their website, just over and over. I mean, I could do it all day long. I would never run out of material. I would not run out of material. But I haven't. I don't do it. But I late there is this in New Zealand, they are apparently talking about moving. Because New Zealand is supposedly this big free-range country, right? With the cows all out in the fields and stuff like that, because we still have a lot more land than we do people population compared to denser urban areas. So New Zealand is a farm country, and there's lots of land. And so there's people used to make fun, but this was back when I was a kid, there was 3 million people. I think now there's like 4.5 or 5. I mean, I don't know how it's growing, but there was like 300 million sheep and 3 million people or something like that. So,
Oh my.
you drive around New Zealand, and there are places in America like this as well. This is such a big continent, but this is quite a small country, and there's lots of farmland. So the cows are all outside, the sheep are all running around outside, and that's what you see. Unless you happen to drive past a cattle truck, or unless you live near a slaughterhouse, that's what you see. You see the fields, which used to be glorious native forest, by the way. It's just grassland now. So anyway, long story short, oh God, I've lost my train of thought. What was I talking about? What was my original thing that I was talking about, Sarah? Help me out here. I've lost my train of thought. What did I start this sentence with? See, this is what I do in my podcast, and I'm like, where was I going? It's like, what am I doing? I'm
I
so
was so
sorry.
focused, I lost it as
I'm so
well.
sorry for rambling.
I
But
was
oh,
just picturing
safe.
sheep in fields.
Yeah, exactly. No, safe. That's right.
Oh yes,
Safe.
the Facebook page.
Yeah. Well, no, everything, everything. And although, like I said, they have been forced to change their rhetoric in defense of the criticism of the abolitionist movement. So they've now got a Go Veg campaign, which don't even get me started. It's worse. And I even saw someone who went on their page and said, "What does Go Veg mean?" And the safe person on Facebook said, "V vegan or vegetarian." You know, so there's no hiding the fact that that's very much their agenda.
So
But
basically, that's go
conflating.
vegan or non-vegan.
Exactly. Thank you.
Please go vegan or non-vegan.
Exactly.
That's
That's.
not confusing at
Oh
all.
no, not a problem. And it does, you know, it just. Oh my God, the damage by. I mean, Gary's the first person who was able to articulate or made me think about it was this conflation of veganism and vegetarianism and how damaging it is. And when he first like says it, you know, there's more suffering in a glass of milk than a pound of steak. Animals used for dairy are kept alive longer, they're treated worse, they go to the same slaughterhouse, those kind of things. Oh, and now I cannot, it bothers me amazingly, and I still have vegans defending it. I go on my page and I post stuff every now and then, and people still come on. But let me just tell you this one thing that I saw, which it's still pretty breathtaking to me. So New Zealand is now starting to bring in these there's legislation that's going to talk about more intensive confinement for dairy, for cows used for dairy, and everybody's up in arms about it. Oh, you know, it's nothing to do with veganism. It's just, oh no, it's our image, and all that. And if you go on the safe, so the safe has jumped on this because they're all about animal welfare, and they're like, write to your, you know, write to your congressperson or whatever. We don't say congressperson, but write to your politician and say we don't want this in New Zealand. It's, you know, and they literally said, cows used for dairy have it, or cows have it pretty bad in the dairy industry. Cows ha already have it pretty bad in the dairy industry. I'm not kidding. Cows already have it pretty bad. Talk about the wishiest, washiest. So their way of, and I just said that's the understatement of the entire century. I took my breath away and I just thought, I can't subject myself to it for very long, so I just left. But yeah, that was pretty shocking. So that's one of their new things, is like cows have it pretty bad in the dairy industry. They've never done a dairy. I mean, they've done a Sauerkraut campaign, they've done a battery egg campaign, but they've never done a stop drinking, you know, milk or anything like that campaign, because most of their donors are. It's all about donations, and so now they finally, Sarah, have a campaign that they can get behind as an organization where they can get donations from. Because before in New Zealand, there was no intensive thingamajigging of you know, putting a cows into to you know indoor facilities the way they're trying to sort of say, whatever you call it, in more confinement. So that we didn't have that, so they didn't really have a welfare campaign. When it turned out that there were fetuses or baby cows being aborted at like 9 months, so there was this, I can't remember what it's called, but it's this horrible thing that they do in the dairy industry where they force the, rather than let the mother give birth, they kill her, and they kill the baby while she, it's a, you know, the baby's pretty much ready to be born. I can't remember, there's this horrible thing that goes on, and they had a campaign about that, like stop cruel, you know, whatever you call it. But they've never been able to do a campaign focused on dairy, because the last thing they're going to do is a go vegan campaign, and the last thing they're going to do is a stop drinking milk campaign, because that's, you can't make donations off that. You can make donations off a veg campaign saying continue to drink milk, you know, that's fine. But now that they've got this, now that the government and everybody and the farmers are trying to put in this intensive confinement of cows, now they have a campaign they can do, because they're not going to tell people to stop drinking milk, but they're going to
Oh
tell people
gosh.
don't put the cows in. So now finally Safe have a campaign that suits their agenda around dairy. And so, you know, and their slogan supposedly is cows already have it pretty bad. I mean, come on. So wishy-washiness is basically the fundamental tenet of the welfareist movement, as far as I'm concerned. I just came up with that now, you know. I just had that realization now, Sarah. That's how my brain works. I have to talk like verbal diarrhea, and then I say, oh my God, I just figured that out. Safe finally have a campaign that they can get behind to do with dairy. They have never ever done anything. Not that I support single issue campaigning, but yeah, they've never, as far as I know, had a campaign about the dairy industry, and that you know, unless it was like a specific targeted practice within the dairy industry, which there's not a heck of a lot of stuff that they do. They mostly battery eggs, and they're mostly sow crates, and they just basically get behind Animals Australia, who just basically follows their lead from HSUS. Basically, that's how it works. So you guys are talking about stuff by HSUS, and then Animals Australia comes along, and they jump on that bandwagon, and then Safe basically imitates completely Animals Australia, even down to the advertising and down to the posters of the flying pigs. You know, the flying pigs.
Wow.
Oh yeah, the Safe poster is—it's a total replica. It's like a mini. It's like Safe is like a mini Animals Australia, basically. So anyway,
you know, it's really too bad. Like the far-reaching effect that this really damaging advocacy and these organizations that are making so much money, and they're making it from non-vegans as well. And like that's another thing with TAVS is like if someone's gonna come onto the TAVS site and make a donation, we tell them, if you're not already vegan, do not make a donation. We want you to go vegan.
Yes.
If you're already vegan and if you're already educating others, then, and you want to do more and extend your reach, then we do take donations from vegans.
Okay.
But it's sad to think about, I think, the far-reaching effects of these organizations and what they're doing, because, I mean, I've seen a lot of vegans looking for hope, and I don't blame them looking for hope, but I've seen a lot of vegans looking for hope in the idea of, you know, the vegan population, quote unquote, having doubled in the last couple years. And I'm really hesitant to, I don't want false hope. Like I find real hope in people who go vegan, and I find real hope in people who learn the abolitionist approach and who start to do TAVS advocacy. Those to me are actual steps forward. But I think we always have to temper, you know, any actual progress or any actual hope with what we're really up against. I think if we don't look at reality, we're not the most strong and the most strategic in our efforts to make a vegan world. And with that said, I read a statistic that I think it was 367,000 humans are born every day. And of course, within, you know, our world, X number of people also pass away per day. So it's not like I think that we've got 365, you know, added on to the world population of 7 billion or 7.2 billion. But I think that, you know, and I'm not a statistician, so unfortunately, I would love to connect with one. So if one is listening, please do contact me at the Abolitionist Vegan Society, because these are some numbers that I really would like deeper insight into. But anyway, now I'm kind of going off on a tangent in that I think that the effect of these organizations is really sad, because if we really want to measure progress, we have to measure not only the number of new vegans, but the number of new vegans in relation to the world population. And if the number of new vegans percentage-wise across the whole world is going down, then we're not keeping up. And so this is why I think it's, again, so critically important that we do TAVS advocacy and that we really make this abolitionist vegan movement, because what's going to happen and what's already happening, unfortunately, is that these large organizations with their sellout campaigns taking money from non-vegans and telling them that they don't have to go vegan and stop their participation in animal exploitation, as factory farming and, you know, these intensive ways of exploiting animals are spreading, and, you know, they're looking at kind of the more cost-effective, you know, mass production, you know, methods of using animals spread into Asia and into other countries. It's like we have to, I think, get ahead of this, because unfortunately, I think we're only seeing the beginning of that. You know, just as intensive animal agriculture is, you know, within the last 50, 60 years, we also have these animal organizations. It's like, in some ways, you know, they're growing and maturing and learning as well. And I think the hope is in this grassroots movement. So it's, I can't emphasize how important it is for everyone to learn and to get involved.
I couldn't agree more. And, you know, the more Sadly, the more that, like I said, in New Zealand now, the more that these intensive or these kind of changes have, then they just have more fuel for non-vegan campaigning, and more
Exactly.
fuel, and they've got more opportunity because, I honestly, I can't say it in a one sentence, but the damage being done by the focus on factory farming, or it's just so incredibly damaging because you get people at your street stall or wherever you finally talk to people about veganism, and the focus is entirely on the treatment, entirely on the treatment.
It's really problematic. I mean, focusing on factory farm, anti-factory farming campaigning is so problematic because you know what's problematic when your average non-vegan on the street agrees with you. Just
Right.
off the bat. I mean, we know that they agree with us that it's wrong to inflict unnecessary suffering and death, and that's why we show them that they agree with us, so to speak, on veganism. But if you were to go up to someone on the street and say, "What do you think of factory farming?" No one's going to be like, "It's fantastic."
Well, yeah,
I mean,
it's exactly. It's not
it's like,
fantastic, and it is horrific, but the problem is that, well, I don't even need to tell you, Sarah. It's when you say to them, well, you need to go vegan in response to all animal use, they're like, oh, well, I'm opposed to factory farming because of the hormones and because it's so cruel, da 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 da. And you have to really bring them back. You have to bring them back a long way from this happy meat idea. The happy meat movement is it's as you say, Sarah, it's growing. And the more non-vegans that are born, and the more that animal farming intensifies or grows and goes into, like I say, places like Asia, and their meat and dairy consumption goes up, the more welfare campaigning, the bigger the animal movement, the mainstream movement's going to get from donations and from giving people their moral pass and taking their sort of that money, like their penance money that means they don't have to actually change, and
Yes.
it's
And I think some of those non-vegans, like I know I've seen some cynicism about, them wanting to pay instead of addressing the moral issue. And I sometimes think that's the case, but I sometimes think it's not, because I was very concerned for animals to the point that in my life before I was vegan, I was seeking out the most humane animal products, but not because I wasn't willing to face the moral issue, because it wasn't part of my paradigm. Like the idea, like I thought we needed animal products to survive. And so the importance of abolitionist vegan education and introducing this new idea, it may seem normal to us, but to many people out there, it's something that is not even in their thought paradigm. So it's like, and I do get concerned too, seeing some of the what I've observed in Asia is like these campaigns. I think I've seen them in Korea so far, is like campaigns to save like the cats and dogs, because the Westerners are having such a problem in our moral schizophrenia with the idea that in some parts of Asia that they eat dogs and cats.
So it's a tourist thing.
And it's becoming like it's becoming their single issue campaign over there, of like, we need to change the way we see dogs and cats. And the idea that, a lot of people eat dog and cat there is actually not true. It's not a pervasive thing like it is in the United States, or like chicken or pork or beef, but it's becoming like their single issue campaign. So you can already start to see that where there could be like a vegan movement planted there,
Yes,
you're
exactly.
already seeing like them get, misled into these single issue campaigns, and you can already see the confusion being perpetuated.
Yeah, it's already happening. Yeah, the damage, it's desperate, and
It is.
it is very, very desperate. So that's why, like you say, I do see a lot of hope, and I am inspired, and there are more and more abolitionists coming out, and there are people who are even, like you say, even some of the welfarists are changing their rhetoric and stuff, but it's not happening nearly fast enough, so
No,
it needs to
it's
happen.
not. And to be honest, like it couldn't happen fast enough. Like
That's right.
we joke
Exactly.
about like, the world's not gonna go vegan overnight,
I
and
wish it
like
would.
even if it did, it's like it wouldn't be fast enough for me. But
Exactly.
We have to get down to business, and we have to, if we care about, if now we're vegan and we, if we're not vegan, we should go vegan. But if we're already vegan and we actually care about ending this, there is a time sensitivity here. The sooner we end this and the sooner we make a vegan world, the less suffering there will be. By honoring veganism and by honoring their right not to be exploited, we automatically honor their right not to suffer, and we reduce suffering. So it's like we have the two movements all wrapped into one.
Well, exactly. In a way, that's so interesting that you say that. Yeah, about how they're reducing suffering. I mean, how weird to think that we are not, that our movement isn't going to reduce suffering. I mean, what a strange, thing to think of about a vegan movement, that it's not going to reduce suffering. It just doesn't make sense to me. People need to educate themselves on the reality of the property status.
Absolutely.
They really do. Well,
That is
Sarah.
so key.
Yeah. Oh, it's number like so important.
It's so key.
I'll ne like I'll never forget the first time I heard that Gary Francione said it in the debate with Eric Marcus. He said, "The thing is, Eric, big sigh. Animals are property." And I was like, he said that as if he's tried. He's finally got a chance to say it to somebody outside of his own brain. Like he's been saying it in his brain and writing books about it for however many long, and then finally, I mean, I'm very grateful to Eric Marcus for allowing Gary Francione on to do that debate. I believe that would never happen now, because he got he lost the debate. I mean, if you want to talk about a debate as to be a win-lose thing, as far as I'm concerned, he lost that debate hands down. Obviously, because I agree with Gary Francione's position. Have you listened to that debate? The interview? Yeah, have you? Okay.
Yes, I did.
Yeah. So I practically know it by heart. I learned so much. I mean, that is why I became a out. That's why I got out there with my street stall. That was what did it. People were telling me I should, the vegans who introduced me to Gary Francione was like, he says you need to do vegan advocacy, and I was like, no, I can't. It's too. It's. I thought vegan advocacy was screaming at people and arguing and very confrontational. I had no idea. But when I heard that interview, I knew it. I knew I had an obligation, and I was like, right, I have to figure out how to do this, or, I'm just letting everybody down, including myself. So, hey, so it's been amazing having you on. Is there anything else you wanted to? I really want to leave people with what you just finished with before, which was how we just need to hurry up and get on with it. So, keep that in
We
mind,
really
everyone.
do. It's time sensitive, and
Yeah.
I mean it, this is abolitionist vegan advocacy and TAS advocacy is getting to the root of the problem. I am, when I formed TAVS, I formed it, with the best philosophy I could find, the best theory that I'm aware of, and I decided I'm sticking to it. I mean, we're gonna give this a go. So, I hope, like, let's say TAVS were to grow and we were to get a lot of vegan support and we were to be able to get donations and build those up. I have really big plans for TAVS. So, vegans can know if they really want to get behind and be part of a movement. I am committed to keeping the funding on veganism. And I have, a lot of ideas, just not the funding right now yet. We're still so new and little. But, vegans can know that I am completely dedicated to veganism. And then I wanted to address one of the questions that came in through the Facebook page, which was Misha, I think his name is. He was asking about, can we speak a little bit about the importance of educating about abolitionist veganism instead of focusing on compassion, which is what the majority of the animal welfare movement does. And I just mainly have one point on that, which is that veganism is about what we directly owe to animals. It's a direct obligation. It is not something that's meant to make us feel good. I mean, it may be, in our transformation of going from being personal exploiters of animals to not, this feels great and it makes us feel compassionate. But really, like, focusing on us and focusing on our feelings and how we feel has really nothing to do with veganism. It's about finally, after eons, respecting these animals and, like, letting them not be exploited and, stopping breeding them. I totally support ending domestication, and I think that, as Professor Francione has outlined in his work. It's like, through domestication, they're only here to be exploited. It's like, it doesn't make any sense to continue it. And so I don't recall using even the word compassion or focusing on any of those sort of ideas, like, that have to do with us and how we feel in not exploiting animals, or what kind of people it makes us to be vegan. I think that's really quite unimportant. I think more important is that we change the conversation to that these animals have a fundamental right to exist and to not, or not to exist, I should say, because within domestication, I actually don't want there to be domesticated animals, but they have a fundamental right not to be exploited and not to be bred. And so with that said, I don't think the focus should be on compassion so much as it should be on the justice issue at hand.
I couldn't agree more. I thank you so much for articulating that, about how I knew there was something that bothered me about it, but I couldn't put my finger on it. There's lots of things that bother me about this, but that is so true. It's a self-centered about our feelings. I also, people need to know that we do understand that we're not saying compassion is a bad thing. It's just not relevant to our position on the direct obligation that we owe, and you just said that very nicely. We also understand the need for community and the need for like-minded people. I mean, I understand that very well, which is why I love that there's more abolitionists. There's more abolitionists, because everybody's like, but like-minded people and stuff, and I'm like, I'm really sorry, but the welfare movement is not like-minded. It's not like-minded to me. I don't have any affinity with it, and I'm not. It's not my community. That's not my movement. So,
and like, you know, with the compassion thing, another way of putting it and thinking about it is like, let's imagine that we lived in a society or in a world where 99% of the population participated in raping children, and you were one of the people that chose not to. Would you see your choosing not to as a compassionate thing? Would you say, I'm such a compassionate person, I don't rape children? Or would you say, of course I don't rape children, that is so wrong?
Yeah, it's
it's not about making ourselves into, like, you know, ultra compassionate people and making it about us.
Yeah, and I mean, obviously, yeah, the thing is, people, Sarah, as we know, people just, you know, words are tricky. Obviously, compassion's not a bad thing. I just want to say that up front. It's not that we're saying don't be compassionate, but there's it's not the primary, yeah, it's not about making yourself feel good. And there are going to be people out there saying, no, it is about compassion, it's about compassion, it's about compassion. Yeah, okay, not robbing your elderly neighbor. Is that about being compassionate towards her, or is that about not doing an injustice toward her? Think about
exactly.
It.
Exactly.
So this is the key, and that's why we want, because the problem, one of the main reasons why I objected to, I actually didn't have the insight that you just provided, Sarah, and I'm actually really grateful to that. I didn't, even without that insight, the welfarist movement, to me, compassionate is just being so perverted, just like everything else. Compassionate means going down and buying cage-free eggs now. Compassionate means buying only organic pasture-raised. You know, so the word itself is being perverted by the movement. All these compassionate consumers. So it's making people feel better about continuing to engage in injustice. I mean, that is about as opposite of compassionate as I could ever think of anyway. But yeah, I totally, I agree with you. So I hope that covered it for Misha. I hope that made our position clear, and why we, you know, don't have that rhetoric in our advocacy. We have things about a commitment to nonviolence, belief in justice for all. I mean, we do have care. You know, it is about caring. It is about having moral, having a moral concern and stuff. Anyway, you already said it. So
I think you're right, though. I think, you know, it's about that the words, so many words have gotten really perverted, and like, you know, just to the point that like Welfare.
Exactly. Exactly.
You know, there's so many words that are just
Animal rights.
really
Animal rights.
unusable, and yeah,
Yep.
animal rights. Yeah,
Yeah.
exactly.
It's
So.
funny because when we're talking about our TAVS chapter, we've got also got lots and lots and lots of ideas. And yes, some a lot of them do cost money. We want to hire a hall and we want to cook a banquet. And yeah, you're right. These things do cost money. I know that you have some really big plans. Can you talk about a couple of the bigger ones?
Yeah,
Like a
oh, definitely. So,
documentary. I know you're planning to do a documentary.
yep, I would like to do. I have two videos in mind that I'm looking to produce. So, if there's any people who are good at video production that would want to do a volunteer project where I want to do a really nice video on veganism, basically why veganism in like 5 minutes or less. That we can put on YouTube. And I also want to do a documentary about the abolitionist vegan movement. I think there's something very special happening, and you know, if we can document that, all for the better. And then, you know, I would also like to invest down, I believe, obviously, in grassroots education, and you know, that will always be the focus of TAVS. But with that said, I really want to get into doing some really big advertising campaigns that are unequivocal and that lead people back to unequivocal vegan education. So I would like to do some public transportation, some billboard campaigns, et cetera, and I would like to do, you know, measuring of the efficacy of these different campaigns and getting people to go to the website and to start to measure, you know, the success of them, and you know, if we can experiment with different things as well. So, but I would really like to see, you know, the efficacy of actual vegan education and measure it, because, you know, we can, to an extent, we can measure it. You know, we can see how many people choose to go vegan, and we can do some surveying and figure out, you know, what influenced them and what had they been thinking about, how had they been misled in the past, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, and going vegan for real and staying vegan, not just like a vegan cleanse or a vegan pledge or something like that. I'm very quick when people say to me I used to be vegan, I always say, "Do you mean you made a vegan diet?" And 99.99999% of the time, it's like, yeah. And I'm like, so you still wore leather, da da da. And they're like, oh, right, yeah. I just ate a vegan diet. And I was like, yeah, you used to eat a vegan diet. You didn't used to be vegan. I had one woman at my stall, one woman whose daughter, this was the other day, whose daughter was vegan, and she was gathering all the information that we had, picking all of it up, which was great. And then she's like, I used to be vegan. And I was like, really? I don't really know. I haven't really met anyone who used to actually be vegan. Do you mean you ate a vegan diet? And she's like, no, I was vegan. I didn't wear leather. I didn't wear wool. I understand it. And we didn't go into why she changed her moral standing.
Wow.
We didn't go into it. But that's in 4 years or whatever of doing it. That's the first person who has actually said that, and I'm still a little skeptical, but it could be. I mean, maybe she had a brain injury. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I sometimes, I have irrational, well, maybe not necessarily irrational, I have irrational fears of getting into a car accident and losing my ability to take care of myself, or to or getting a brain injury and not being vegan anymore, going back. I have a fear of that. I have little daytime scary moments where I'm like, I need a vegan. Like, I think my brother would be. My brother's not vegan, but he intuitively actually gets it. It's just I'm waiting for him to go vegan. But I think he would take care of me. So if I ended up in the hospital with a brain injury and they brought in my Auckland Hospital corned beef meal, I mean, I would. I'm terrified that. That just sounds so strange, Sarah. But I have to tell
You
you,
should make a living will.
Yeah, that's a great. I should do that. I
And
really, really
put that in
should.
there as
Yeah,
like, you know, your
I'm vegan. Yeah, like no
specifications.
matter what happens to my brain, I'm
Even if I
vegan.
tell you I'm not vegan, I'm vegan still.
Yeah, exactly. Oh God. But I tell you what, I met this amazing woman at the stall that we did in Graylin at the Graylin Festival. We did the stall to TAVS. It was the first. I think it was our first stall as a TAVS chapter, and I learned a lot because of the wind and because I have so much because it's so windy here, and I had so many posters and so much sellotape and so many little things to manage and fall over, and they were getting blown away. And then one of my Facebook sort of page members, who is very easy to discuss with. I definitely don't agree with him on a lot of things, but he said he's from I think Austria, so I think it was the language, but he said it's a overwhelming. It's too much. What did he say? It's like the message is too much, and I immediately took that to mean too much of a focus on veganism, and I was like, oh no, don't even go there. But then when I read it again, I think he meant information overload. Like I had 3 or 4 posters basically saying the same things in different ways. So you looked at my stall, and it was like all of this duplication of information. And I am going to simplify. I'm inspired by the beautiful stalls in Brazil by Vera Cristofani and Geffran and things like that. And so I'm going to simplify my stall. But anyway, I'm going on a tangent. But anyway, this woman I met, and I wish I could remember her name. So she was from England. She met Ava Batts. Do you know who Ava Batts is? Mm-hmm. Okay, so she met Ava Batts and worked with Ava Batts, the original founders. She is an unequivocal, like the old vegans used to be abolitionists. They were abolitionists. Something terrible happened when it got away from them. They were all abolitionists, and so she told me, I mean, she met them, she was with them, she's having Christmas, for example. She lives in New Zealand, she lives in farm country near the cows, and she can hear them crying for their babies every single season.
Oh my gosh.
It's heartbreaking, but she's like, I loved her so much, I gave her a huge hug, because she's like us, Sarah. She's like us, and she was like, my husband's family's coming over for Christmas dinner, and it's at my house this year, and it's like nothing non-vegan is coming in my house, and that's that. And that's that is just it. And I know that other people say the same thing, but you just had to meet her. Like she's like, she's the way we're going to be when we're 60 or 50. You know what I mean? Like she's like just so awesome. And she loved, like, because she's been surrounded by this welfare stuff, and she's like, what the hell happened, right? She's like, what the hell happened? And she came to our stall, and she was like, oh my God, this is so great. The real thing. You know, it's come back. Like it's come back. It went away and now it's come back. And she told me about one of the founders, one of Ava Batt and Donald Watson's colleagues and partners and associates, you know, in the vegan society, became senile, got dementia. And they didn't know where she was, and nobody could find her. And they finally found her in an old people's home. And they were feeding her non-vegan food. So they got together, and they made sure that until the day she died, she had vegan food for the rest of her life.
Wow.
They did that for her. And I said to her, oh my God, you know, this is one of my fears, is that that's going to happen to me. She said, yeah, because you're at the mercy of the non-vegan world. If you're senile and, you know, you're in this world, I mean, you know, like if I went to hospital and I lost the ability to speak, to say I'm vegan, or the ability to sort of, if I was sort of in semi-conscious, they would be feeding me, like you say, I need to write it down and put it in my will or something, because
definitely, and give copies to family. I mean, if anything, for peace of mind, just so that you know.
Yeah, and I need to, and I need to do something for the cats as well.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah, I have to live. I have to live. I am not allowed to die. Because of Shebi and Buddha. And, you know, in future, I'm sure I will try to help more refugees. I do very little in that regard. But, you know, I love the, you know, there's people who do so much and I do support them, but I actually don't do very much in that regard. So, but definitely them. I mean, I look at Shebi and Buddha, and when they're safe, that is for me the only time that, like you say, we need hope, and we need those calm moments, and we need those happy moments of equilibrium. And for me, it's when they're asleep and they're safe, and I know that they're safe and nothing bad's going to happen to them. And I know that they live in a world in which terrible things are right around the corner if somebody hadn't taken them in. So I do know that they are. That gives me great comfort when I see them. Great, great, great comfort. I'm sure the way a mother who sees her children are safe, but the difference is it's like a mother living in a war zone who sees her children safe. That's what I feel when I see the cats safe. I'm like, so the vast majority of their brethren or whatever are monstrously unsafe and are being, yeah, so we do need to comfort ourselves. Yes. Okay, gosh, this has been so great. You'll have to come back on. There's just no doubt
I
about
would love to. This has been
it.
fabulous.
It's
Thank you
awesome.
so
Yeah, and
much.
I'm so thank you so much for agreeing to come on. And I've been really wanting people to hear your voice and to get to know you and things, because it's like you do all this work on the computer and you do so much. It's just so lovely to put a voice. You know, I'd love to put a face to the name with video one day, but I mean, you know, a voice to the to this force behind the movement. And I am a very grateful to all for all that you do, and I fully support you, obviously. And yeah, it's just so
Likewise, and
I'm so
thank you so
glad.
much for letting me come on. It's been really fun, and
Yeah.
I'll come back anytime.
Yes, awesome, Sarah. Well, thank you so much. I'll let you go because I know it's late there. Definitely come back on the show. And everyone, I'm going to post links to all kinds of things. Sarah actually has another project of her own. It's almost like my NZ vegan thing on the side. She has farmed animal friends. And I was going to get you to talk a little bit about that, Sarah, but I think maybe we can do that another time. That was before Tabs. And that's
Yes.
but it's a wonderful page. It's a Facebook page and a blog. And the blog is where your story, one of the, you've published some articles on there, and you've published your story about how you became an abolitionist vegan. And I also want, I encourage people to read that story. I love that story. It's a beautiful story. It's so well written, and there's so much truth in it, and there's so much, you know, I think in it to inspire other people to say, this is actually a really convincing and genuine story. And I hope they sort of open themselves up to the possibility of becoming abolitionist vegans as well. So I'll post links to all those things on the blog, nzveganpodcast.blogspot.com, everyone. Thank you so much for listening, Sarah. Have a wonderful evening.
Thank you so much.
And we'll talk again soon.
Sounds great.
Bye.
Bye.